Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this third episode of the EAN podcast, this time about coma and prolonged disorders of consciousness. My name is Rolf Fronsek. I'm a neurologist and somnologist from Leiden University Medical Center, the Netherlands. And I'm here together with my co-moderator, Nicolas Lejeune. Maybe you can briefly introduce yourself, Nicolas.
Hello, everybody. I'm Nicolas Lejeune. I'm a neurologist at William Lennox Rehabilitation Center in Belgium. And I'm also a researcher at the Coma Science Group in Liège. And I'm also a part of the managing group on coma and disorder of consciousness of the EAN.
Thank you. And our guest today is Anna Estraneo. She is a clinical neurologist and researcher with expertise in neurophysiology and neurorehabilitation and care of patients with severe brain injury. And she has a special research interest in the prognosis of patients with prolonged disorders of consciousness. And that's the topic of today. So maybe, Anna, can you give us a brief introduction about where you work and what kind of work you do with these patients?
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Rolf. Thank you, Nicolas. And also, thank you. I would to thank, before starting, I would to thank the European Academy of Neurology for inviting me to provide an update on prognosis of patients with the prolonged disorder of consciousness, as I think it is an important topic for the neurologists. Indeed, since the acute phase in the intensive care unit, the neurologist might be called to identify patients with the high probability of improvement in order to plan an appropriate care pathway in terms of intensity and duration of treatment for these patients. Many neurologists are also involved in the follow-up of such patients, and thus they have to provide the patients' families with the reliable prognostic information for guiding decision-making on long-term management. So, what we know nowadays about possible clinical evolution of such patients? As maybe the neurologists already know, after a comatose state due to a severe acquired brain injury with traumatic or non-traumatic etiology, survivors may remain in clinical condition of wakefulness without awareness, the so-called vegetative state, recently named as a responsive wakefulness syndrome. Clinically, these patients have their eyes open, are awake, but there is no evidence of conscious behaviors such as coma following or vis-a-vis. Within the continuum from VS, from the evolution from VS to full awareness, we can have an intermediate state called the minimally conscious state, in which the patients regain minimal, inconsistent, but clearly discernible clinical signs of intentional conscious responses to standardized stimuli. Quite recently, the MCS patients have been subcategorized into two subgroups on the basis of the complexity of their behaviors. In the first group, MCS minus, the patients can exhibit low-level intentional behaviors, such as a visual pursuit of silent stimuli. For instance, they can visually follow their face in a mirror, or they can localize the pain stimulation by their hand. In the second group, the minimally conscious state plus, the patients show high level of behavioral interactions, such as language comprehension and common following, and intentional but non-functional communication. These three clinical conditions, vegetative state, minimally conscious state minus, and minimally conscious state plus, are often transitional states between coma and full recovery of consciousness. However, some patients can remain in a chronic condition of disorder of consciousness, of a prolonged disorder of consciousness, even for a lifetime. Some other patients do recover full consciousness, but Unfortunately, not all of them recover functional motor and cognitive abilities to the same extent. Indeed, the recovery of consciousness most often does not parallel the functional ability recovery. This is, in summary, the possible evolution of such severe patients. Actually, we have the first difficulty in defining a possible evolution, the recognition of a new category of patients, the so-called patients with the covert cognition or covert awareness, or patients with the cognitive motor dissociation. These patients are about 20% of patients clinically classified as in vegetative state, in whom advanced tools such as functional neuroimaging can detect residual cortical activation suggestive of residual conscious processing. The presence of covert cognition seems to have important prognostic significance as it is a sign of a positive clinical evolution. So recognize these patients is therefore important for making prognosis. However, this identification of the recognition of covert cognition poses a critical challenge as advanced neuroimaging or advanced neurophysiological tools by combining transcranial magnetic stimulation and EEG, which are crucial for identifying this category, cannot be applied in all patients due to technical problems such as patients' agitation or presence of mechanical ventilation. In addition, although these advanced tools have been recommended by recent EAN guidelines on diagnosis of a prolonged disorder of consciousness, these tools are not widely available in routine care due to logistical problems or lack of expertise. So we can have, unfortunately, a misdiagnosis of such patients.
Anna, thank you for this insight. But I would like to ask you a very basic question about the natural recovery of a patient with a disorder of consciousness. We've long been told that the prognosis mainly differ from the etiology, from anoxic or from traumatic brain injury etiology, so with a worse outcome with anoxic patient. Is it still true, or could you give us some advice also to identify some prognosis factor in the acute stage and subacute stage, maybe?
It's true. Yes. Actually, what do we know about the predictors of clinical evolution, of a recovery of a consciousness? First, we know that the probability of a recovery is, of course, partially related to the etiology. That is, patients with the traumatic etiology have a better outcome than those with the non-traumatic etiology, that is, vascular and anoxic etiology. Actually, in 19, the Multi-Society Task Force on Vegetative State in 1994 suggested that patients with in vegetative state with the traumatic etiology can recover their consciousness until 12 months post-injury, whereas patients in anoxic and vascular etiology with anoxic and vascular etiology can recover their consciousness until 3-6 months post-injury. More recently, several observations and description of late recovery of consciousness beyond this classical time limit suggested that we can have a late recovery of consciousness after this classical time limit, and suggested so the need to long-term monitoring such patients. We also know that regardless of the etiology, the clinical diagnosis may affect the outcomes. as a patients in MCSP in minimally conscious state have a better outcome than patients in vegetative state. This different outcome in the two diagnostic groups could be mainly due the more severe brain damage in VS patients, but also because patients in MCS show better response to specific treatment, such as pharmacological neuromodulation or transcranial and other therapeutic strategy of neuromodulation, transcranial direct electric stimulation. In addition, as expected, advanced age may also negatively affect the clinical evolution because of comorbidities that are more frequent in elderly disorder of consciousness patients. In conclusion, age, etiology, and clinical status affect the clinical evolution.
Maybe in line with this, can you maybe for general neurologists also give some tricks, like what kind of clinical tests or clinical signs should we look at when we test these patients, when we assess these patients?
About prognostic markers, until now we know that the most reliable solid prognostic marker of poor recovery of consciousness, especially in anoxic patients, is the lack in anoxic comatose patients, so in the acute phase, is the lack of an N20 cortical component on bilateral somatosensory evocative potential elicited by electric stimulation on upper limbs. For this reason, this predictor has been included in the algorithm for prognostication of comatose patients due to cardiac arrest, as recommended by the recent guidelines of the European Society of Intensive Care Medicine for comatose patients. However, despite its clear utility, this sample measure is rarely recorded in intensive care unit, and neurologists of the post-acute phase most often lack such prognostic information. In addition, the presence of somatosensory evocative potential is a necessary but not sufficient condition for recovery of consciousness. In fact, patients with the presence of N20 component and somatosensory evocative potential may have different outcomes. Indeed, generation of N20 component in the somatosensory cortex requires low metabolic demand, and so this cortical evocative potential disappears only after very, very severe brain damage. So we can have patients with different level of brain damage with SEP, with the presence of SEP. Based on this critical issue on the prognostication, a recent joint collaboration between the International Brain Injury Association and an European consortium within an European project launched a multicenter longitudinal study involving 12 medical centers located in Asia, Europe, and America. This project I coordinated and involved two Nicolas aimed at identifying predictors for probability of recovery in short, 6 months of post-injury, long, 12, a very long-term outcome, until 24 months post-injury.
So I just wonder, what are factors that you didn't think of? What were the most critical ones or the most unexpected predictors?
We found that beyond the expected positive role of lower age, shorter time post-injury, two additional markers predicted the recovery of consciousness, both at 6 and 24 months post-injury. One marker is clinic. Higher level of responsiveness as measured by validated behavioral tool, the Coma Recovery Scale Revised to a score that is the gold standard for diagnosis of disorder of consciousness, and also a scale recommended by the European Academy of Neurology guideline for diagnosis. One other marker was neurophysiological, the presence of eye opening reactivity on standard EEG. Moreover, the EEG reactivity has the highest prognostic value, as its presence is associated with a 5 times higher probability to recover consciousness. the same markers, the same exam can predict mortality in such patients. The clinical assessment by coma recovery scale vaso score, the AEG, are informative for predicting mortality risk. Indeed, the same cohort of patients, a lower coma recovery scale vaso score, was significantly associated with a higher mortality risk in patients in vegetative state, whereas the absence of alpha rhythm on AEG, that is a poor organization of a background activity on AG, was significantly associated with the high risk of mortality in MCS group. In conclusion, our results, already published in two papers in Neurology and European Journal of Neurology, supported the usefulness of a multimodal assessment of disorder of unconsciousness, including both standardized clinical assessment, the coma recovery scale revised, and the basic neurophysiological evaluation, including EEG and somatosensory evoked potential. That is, markers that all neurologists can collect in all settings.
I had a question, and so that's a very good news that almost all main interesting findings that you're talking about are EEG and behavioral assessments that are very easily collected in a clinical routine. But is there any place for more advanced techniques such as fMRI or also structural MRI? Do you have any idea about how this could predict the recovery in the acute stage, maybe, or more later in the course of the disease?
Advanced techniques such as functional neuroimaging or sophisticated neurophysiological assessment such as transcranial magnetic stimulation or event-related potential too are not widely available in acute phase and also in post-acute phase for such patients due to technical problems, due to patient agitation, and also these techniques are more complex to record and to analyze in such patients. We have some recent paper suggesting the useful of such advanced tool in post-acute phase, especially the PET, the positron tomography, as high metabolic intake in such patients can predict recovery of consciousness. Also, advanced tools such as functional neuroimaging can recognize patients with the residual brain activity, patients with the covert cognition. I hope in the future we can increase the use of such availability of these tools.
Thanks, Anna. I would also like to know, these patients are, as you said, on the behavioral assessment, it is very predictive for their recovery at around 1 month, I think, at the best timing to know if a patient will evolve, if he displays some sign of consciousness or not. But what is the usual evolution of this kind of patient? Do they recover full consciousness or did they stay disabled? How disabled do they remain in the long-term outcome? Could you give us some insight about this, please?
Yes. As I said before, more recently, we described patients with late recovery of consciousness, that is recovery of consciousness beyond the classical time limit until 24 months post-injury, especially in younger patients, especially in traumatic patients. But such patients with late recovery of consciousness have very severe cognitive and motor disabilities, likely due to the long-term immobility and medical complication. This population of patients are more complex and with high risk of medical complication, infection, muscle atrophy, pressure sore, pneumonia. So these patients have a lower especially patients with the late recovery consciousness, have a high level of disability and unfortunately a poor quality of life. However, also a late recovery of functional ability have been described in a recent big database in the United States, the TBI model system, including enrolling traumatic veteran individuals with disorder of consciousness, demonstrated that can have a different trajectory of recovery of ability in self-care mobility, and in particular in self-care mobility and in cognitive performance. And we can have some patients who can recover such three domains until 10 years from injury. So this study, this big database, suggests to monitor and to plan a long-term rehabilitation program for such patients, especially young patients.
Thank you for these insights. And we're almost at the end. So maybe there's one final message or take-home message you want to give us before we wrap up.
My message is to use for prognostication tools easy to use in all settings and in all patients. Basic clinical assessment by using the Coma Recovery Scale Revised, and also the standard EEG with the visual analysis of background activity and eye reactivity on EEG, that are very easy to record at the bedside, not time consuming, not expensive, so feasible in all settings for patients, as these two markers are very informative for prognosis.
Thank you for that. I think that's very good advice for all neurologists. And thank you, Dr. Astroneo, for these for all of this, and thank you for listening to this podcast. Thank you, Nicolas, and we hope that all listeners will tune in again for our next episode. But for now, this is the end of this episode. Thank you all.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EAN Cast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.